Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Each year in the United States, there are approximately 330,000 total hip replacements, surgeries done. And for the most part, it appears that that procedure is very good, and most people have a better life with less pain and more mobility. However, as we've said on the program before, any treatment has risk. Today we're going to be discussing an evolving problem with metal-on-metal hip replacements with Jane Shelby. Dr. Shelby is director of the Alaska WAMI School of Medical Education and assistant dean at the University of Washington School of Medicine, and Anchorage orthopedic surgeon Dr. Steve Tower, who's brought to national and maybe even, it's fair to say, international attention some of these issues with metal-on-metal hips. But before we get going, one definition I want to share before we get some definitions about what's going on with hip replacement surgery is WAMI stands for Washington, Wyoming, Alaska, Montana, and Idaho. That is a joint school of medicine that encompasses students from each of those states. So if you hear that concept again, WAMI, that's what that is all about. Jane, welcome to Line One. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Steve? You're an old fellow here. I'm getting used to seeing you once a year or so.
Well, I think this is the third time we've actually addressed metal-on-metal hip issues on this show.
It gets more and more interesting.
And looking back, I didn't remember this, but we did a show on, I think, the catastrophic polyethylene failures in hips before that. And then we did that show on pediatric trauma.
Yep.
So I guess this is the fifth time for me. Yeah.
And for some reason, I remember talking to you a little bit about the work you've done in Kenya, I believe it was.
Kenya, Uganda, and Liberia.
Right. Well, we won't go there today. Let's talk about hip replacement surgery. Give us all a little bit of review, and I may have to stop you every once in a while to define some of these different techniques and things, instruments that are being used.
I think what people need to know about hip replacement is it's been a very successful, well-established procedure since at least 1970 was when the first really successful hip designs that came out, and those were fairly simple devices. It was the surgeon would go in and amputate the ball of the femur right below the ball at the femoral neck and cement a stem into the femur that had a fairly small ball attached to it. And then he would go into the hip socket and cement in a plastic liner into the bony hip socket that was made out of polyethylene. So that was the prototypical, what we call metal on plastic hip. And we tend to name artificial hips based on the material of the ball and the material that the ball is rubbing against, which would be the socket or the socket liner. A brilliant physician and humanitarian, Dr. John Charnley, not single-handedly, but nearly so, developed the modern hip replacement starting, I believe, in the late 50s, and it took him about a decade get a very successful hip that was very consistent in its results. And the results of Dr. Charnley's hip, which was called the low-friction arthroplasty, done in the 1970s in the Mayo Clinic, a series that my senior partner Declan Nolan actually was primarily involved in assembling. He looked at 2,000 patients. It was the first 2,000 patients that Mayo Clinic did that procedure on. And those patients have been followed out 40 years. And even though that technique was new to Mayo Clinic, and even though it was largely performed by trainee surgeons, the success was extraordinary. Those implants failed at a rate of 0.5% per year. So I think it's critical that people always assume that newer is better. And you offer a new widget or a new procedure or offer people a different way to put in a hip, people will beat a path to your door. But I think it's critical that everybody get into this conversation realizing that coming into the 1970s, we had an extraordinarily successful device for patients who had were being seriously disabled by completely worn out hips.
And Dr. Shelby, how did you get involved? What was the led you to get interested in this area?
Well, I've only been here in Alaska as the director of the WAMI program for about 20 months. But soon after I arrived, Dr. Tower, who is a WAMI alumni, and he has also taught for the program here in Anchorage at UAA for a number of years, he was knocking on my door, telling me his story. And I have a great interest in surgical problems. I was a tenured associate professor of surgery at the University of Utah. So I've always been interested in research involving surgical patients and what problems. So this really piqued my interest. And I also saw a big potential for developing a program where our medical students perhaps could help with some of the research in looking at patients from Dr. Tower's clinic and helping to figure out what's going on.
Okay, I understand that. Steve, I kind of jumped ahead there. I wanted to get Jane in really quickly. So we got this phenomenally successful Charnley hip being put in at the Mayo Clinic. Bring us a little bit up to date again.
Well, you know, what retrospectively, because it's always easy to look back in history and, you know, have theories about why things happen. As soon as it became clear that Dr. Charnley had developed a very successful hip, a contemporary hip that was not as successful, or at least it was soon abandoned, was the first generation of metal-on-metal hips, where both the ball that was cemented into the femur was made out of chrome cobalt. The liner that was cemented into the pelvis was also chrome cobalt. That was called a McKee-Farrah hip. And that was really contemporaneous with Dr. Charnley's hip, actually predated it slightly. And over the path of the decade, implantations of the McKee-Farrah stopped, and those of the Charnley continued. And it wasn't really that well documented as to why surgeons stuck with the Charnley and chose not to stick with the McKee-Farrah. In retrospect, there were a few papers suggesting that some of the patients with the McKee-Farrahs were having problems around the hip where they were getting destruction of the tissues around the hip as a reaction to the debris from the cobalt-on-cobalt articulation. But as soon as Dr. Charnley's operation was clearly a great success, I think just the nature of the human ego and the nature of economy is everybody wanted to get into that market, and many surgeons thought they had better ideas than Dr. Charnley. And there were many, many, many changes made by different companies to Dr. Charnley's design, although Dr. Charnley's design pretty much has endured unaltered. And there was always theories about why changing Dr. Charnley's design might be better for patients. One theory, Dr. Charnley used a fairly small head, only about an inch in diameter, whereas the original equipment is more like 2, 2.5 inches in diameter. And that really small head, although it worked very well, I think it just kind of offended people. It didn't look right. When Dr. Charnley, Charnley hip done by Dr. Charnley's method actually had a fairly low dislocation rate. But when surgeons started putting in Dr. Charnley's hips through other approaches, the smaller heads were noted to have a higher dislocation rate. So the desire to use a larger head was one thing that really drove innovation. And there were many designs that looked a lot like Dr. Charnley's hip, only they had a larger head. And once those were followed out 10 years or so, they performed reasonably well. But they didn't perform as well as Dr. Charnley's hip because the larger heads produced more plastic wear debris. And it was actually plastic wear debris was the means by which the hip would eventually fail. Is in a reaction to the plastic debris, people would tend to absorb bone around the parts and pieces, and eventually the parts and pieces would become loose and need to be redone, or what we call a revision surgery. The evolutionary process was very, very quick. And it became clear that most of these designs, in fact, very few, have performed as well as the Charnley. And oftentimes they've been modified so many times, it was unclear which part of the evolution was responsible for the deterioration in results.
Let's bring ourselves up to date. So people coming in today, talking to physicians about the possibility of a hip replacement, what are they discussing? What are the options they have as far as materials and approaches and instruments that are being done, or surgeries that are being done?
Well, there's a huge number of options. I would say where the landscape has radically changed in the past couple of years is in 2006, when I had my hip done, for a younger, more active patient, probably the majority of those patients were getting a metal-on-metal hip. It was a successor, actually the third generation of metal-on-metal hip. It was really the technique of hip resurfacings drove that technology. By using a metal-on-metal design, you could cap, instead of cutting the ball at the neck, you could machine it and put a thin cap of chrome cobalt on it and then line the socket with a thin shell of chrome cobalt. So back to a metal-on-metal bearing like the McKee-Farrar had. And that was hugely successful from a marketing standpoint. Unfortunately, it was very poorly conceived and has turned into a disaster. So today, at least I can tell you in Anchorage, Alaska, no surgeon will offer you a metal-on-metal or a hip resurfacing. The metal-on-metal hips, when they came into common use about a decade ago, came in two flavors. There was the resurfacing device. And then there was the other device looked more like the hips I've been putting in for the past 20 years, ever since training. They involve a stem that goes inside the femur bone, either fixed with cement or press fit with technology where the bone will grow into metal. And then on that head, you would just put a very large chrome cobalt head, which would articulate with a thin shell of metal inside the pelvis. So the bearing was actually the same as a hip resurfacing, only the design had a stem, which was more familiar to surgeons like myself. And the stemmed large ball metal-on-metal hips actually were implanted a lot more than the hip resurfacings. With the events over the past several years, the stemmed large ball metal-on-metal hips have basically disappeared. There's only been two that have been formally recalled. Actually, there's only been one that's been formally recalled from the market. In theory, multiple companies still have metal-on-metal hips on the market. But if I were to approach one of those companies and say I was going to be putting one in tomorrow, I suspect they wouldn't be able to produce the parts and pieces for me to do the operation.
Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. My guests today are Dr. Jane Shelby. She's director of the Alaska WAMI School of Education, assistant dean of the University of Washington School of Medicine, and Anchorage orthopedic surgeon, Dr. Steve Tower. What we have been doing is kind of going over a little bit of briefly the history of total hip replacements in the United States. We're about to get into some questions and issues that have resulted from that that I think anyone thinking about hip replacement and or people who've had some hip replacements really needs to pay close attention to. If you have any questions during the next 45 minutes or so now, here's some contact number. Our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And you can email us at line1, and you have to spell that out all as one word, line1@alaskapublic.org. So, Steve, Dr. Shelby has mentioned you quickly came into her office after you got here because of your story. So let's get your story so it'll introduce the issue that things are not all okay with all of these hip transplants, at least the metal-on-metal in particular. There's some issues.
Yeah, I came in. I've been an orthopedic surgeon in Anchorage since 1992. And in training, total joint replacements, in particular hips, and revision of hip replacements and fractures around hip replacements was my special area of research. So I've always been very interested in that. And hip replacement was the first operation I ever saw. And I've always just loved hip replacement. And it's ironic because as a young adult, I developed end-stage hip arthritis. And at the age of 49, it was apparent that I needed my hip replaced. And I had had significant symptoms of the hip for almost a decade before I had it replaced. I took the same advice I would give my patients, is don't have a hip replaced until you're really having some significant difficulties with activities of daily living and you're having to give up a few activities because it is a procedure that has significant risks attached to it. And we've always had concerns about putting hip replacements in particularly young or particularly active individuals being concerned that they might wear the implants out and have to undergo revision surgery fairly soon after the first operation. But it was clear I needed a hip in 2006. Even though I've been in private practice in Alaska, I remained involved in research involving hip replacement. And in 2000, a few years before, research actually 5 years before I had my hip performed, I had uncovered some of the weaknesses in contemporary metal on plastic hip designs at a time where we were pushing the head sizes larger and larger and making the plastic thinner and thinner. And I ran into a series of patients that had catastrophic failure of their thin plastic liners. And I wrote up the first case series of that particular brand of implant, that particular plastic, and those failures. And that was published in our leading orthopedic journal in America, and I presented that at the big annual meeting. But I was, at that time, quite an active athlete, and I thought that for my needs, I would want one of those larger balls. And I had significant reason to be concerned about a metal-on-plastic hip that had a thin liner. And that steered towards the metal-on-metal hips for that reason, because the metal-on-metal hip resurfacings and the large head metal-on-metals were being very extensively promoted to my demographic, young, active, sports-minded individual with the thought that maybe the metal-on-metal articulation would not wear. The initial bench laboratory data suggests that there was no wear, that the bearing surfaces would be prevented by fluid film lubrication. And what's more, it allows you to put in a ball pretty much the size of the original equipment, which should, in theory, make for a very, very stable hip. So a patient might be able to return to unrestricted athletic activity. And I kind of drunk the Kool-Aid, there had been a 10-year run-up. It was, and there had been an interval generation of metal-on-metal hips between the McKee Farrah and the hip I got that used a fairly small head, an inch and a half head. And those looked good on paper. It seemed to be a viable concept. And I wasn't willing to adopt it for common use in my patients because I thought it was a little premature. I didn't think it had the track record, but I figured that it wouldn't be harm, you know, it wouldn't hurt me to try it myself. And so that's how I wound up with a DePuy stemmed large head ASR in May of 2006. And the long and short of it was, over a period of 42 months, that hip wore excessively. I started experiencing hip pain again with activity. But more concerning, just out of curiosity, I started checking my blood cobalt and chromium levels. And they were hundreds of times normal and 100 times the standard used in industry to indicate concern for excessive industrial exposure to hard metals. And during that period of time, developed some significant neurologic and cardiac issues. And eventually, the hip came out because of my increasing pain around the hip. And my surgeon found that the tissues around the hip had been extensively destroyed by metal debris. And then the other surprise was within a month or two of the hip coming out, all these acquired neurologic problems and cardiac problems resolved. And during my romance or honeymoon period with my own metal-on-metal hip, I put six of them in patients. And one of my patients, I put the same hip in that I had, and he experienced much the same problems, fortunately, at a lesser degree. And based on that experience, I actually wrote up the first two case reports of cobalt poisoning by hip replacement or cobalt poisoning by contemporary metal-on-metal hip replacements. I know now that other people had actually described that and published it, but the cobalt in those reports was produced by wear of a cobalt head by ceramic bits left over from a previous hip replacement, which had failed because the ceramic ball had broken, leaving very abrasive bits of ceramic behind.
So the question I have to ask is, you said you started having neurologic problems, your hip failed, you had to have it replaced. What made you jump to the idea you wanted to see what your cobalt level was?
Well, I was curious. Again, I had a publication about a failure, unknown failure mechanism of another popular hip implant. And I'd been doing hip replacements in patients for nearly 20 years. And this story of a patient coming into me at a year after hip replacement say, gee, doc, this is, you know, my hip has become painful again after activity. It's not a story I was used to hearing. Mm-hmm. I hadn't mm-hmm. seen my patients complain of that with metal-on-plastic hips. Mm-hmm. And my x-rays all looked fine. I didn't have any signs of loosening. But, you know, I would go for a long bicycle ride, and symptoms would start about the 50-mile mark. And then if I did a century, the hip would be sore for, you know, a week or so afterwards. And there was something clearly about a certain level of activity that was triggering pain. And the heavy metal levels in the blood was a research tool that the surgeons and the companies developing the metal-on-metal hips had investigated as a marker for the rate of wear of the metal-on-metal bearing surfaces. And measurements of heavy metals in blood has been done for a long time. It's been used to monitor patients in industry. It's a send-out lab, generally, but it's not that difficult to get. So it started off as a matter of curiosity, and then when I got my levels back, my first level, I believe, was 40 for cobalt. Dr. Woodard's level is probably 0.2. My level is currently 0.2 since mm-hmm. my hip went out. Mm-hmm. So that was hundreds of times normal. Mm-hmm. And then I started to do some research and learned that in industry, there had been cases of cobalt poisoning reported related to exposure to cobalt powders. And for that reason, workers who were involved in cobalt-related industry, heavy metals, machine tools, they monitor the workers. And if you have a blood cobalt level greater than one at the end of the work week, they feel there's been a failure of industrial hygiene. Eventually, my level peaked out at 122, so 122 times higher than what's tolerated in industry. And while this was all going on, I was kind of calling up the company that made the hip and calling up all my academic orthopedic surgeon friends and said, is anybody concerned about, you know, high blood cobalt levels in hip replacement patients? And nobody was.
Jane, I want to bring you in just one more time quickly before we take our break. So you had mentioned that when Steve was telling you this story, your immediate idea is how else can we take advantage of this in the university level and research it in different ways? What are the specific thoughts? There's an engineering school at UAA and other issues that may have come to mind?
Oh, right. There's so many aspects to this story that lend itself to research. So there's epidemiology. We could look at patients at risk and set up screening programs. Mm-hmm. We could look at the biomechanics of the hips, and certainly engineering could help with that. We have heavy metal researchers in chemistry and biology at UAA. And then this is also a story that the medical students should learn about and be involved in the research, learn how to critically think when they are given marketing information about a new therapy. They should be critical and skeptical before they try anything new with their patients. That's part of what we teach them.
Yeah. We need to keep teaching everybody that skepticism. And what we mean by skepticism, people got the wrong idea about skepticism. Mm-hmm. But just show me the money.
Right. Evidence-based
evidence?
Medicine.
And it's
exactly.
Gotten, you know, I love talking about science. It's not just the evidence. There's a lot of lousy evidence out there, too. It's got to be really good evidence, mm-hmm. and that's where things get hard. All right, so it's time to take a break. I want to remind listeners once again, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433. You can email us in the next 30 minutes at line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short break and then rejoin my guest, Dr. Jane Shelby and Dr. Steve Tower. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. We're speeding through a history of metal on metal, in particular hip transplants, and trying to get to some very specific and worrisome problems that are perhaps growing in our recognition and in nature and importance. My guest is Dr. Steve Tower, who's a local orthopedic surgeon, just expressed his history of a hip transplant that gave him cobaltism and some significant illness related to that. Also, Jane Shelby, who she's director of the Alaska WAMI School of Medicine, is also assistant dean at the University of Washington School of Medicine. So, Steve, we're up to this point where I think we can surmise, since I've twice now jumped ahead to Jane before the whole story got out, that things got worse. You noticed you had some problems, and we're going to be talking about a lot more people who noticed the problems. So let's stick with cobaltism, a problem with a heavy metal in metal on metal hip repairs. What symptoms might people who have that have, And then who's at risk?
Yeah, I'd like to just a shout out to Dr. John Sotos, who wrote The Physical Lincoln. He's the guy who coined the phrase cobaltism. Okay. And he was a freshman classmate of mine at Dartmouth. And he's a doctor. He's the consultant for House, the medical consultant for House. And because of getting Sotos involved was how that episode occurred a few years ago. And that episode has actually been credited with saving a German gentleman's life. Recently, in a publication in Lancet, a German diagnostician credited House with coming up with a diagnosis of cobaltism in a patient that presented to him deaf, blind, and in heart failure, and also with low levels of thyroid in the blood. And if you take cobalt poisoning to an extreme, whether the cobalt poisoning is from a hip replacement or whether it's from medical treatment, we used to treat people with cobalt, not radioactive cobalt, but cobalt chloride for anemia. At one time, cobalt was added to beer, and there were case toxicity reports in alcoholics who drank a lot of beer, but also were at risk for the heart problems, not only because of cobalt, but also because they were also drinking a lot of beer. And high alcohol intake also puts people at risk for heart problems, and industrial exposure. And no matter what the mode of exposure is, when patients get too much cobalt, they tend to develop problems with the central nervous system. So that's the brain and the cranial nerves, which is like eyesight and hearing. They develop problems with the peripheral nervous system, and that's generally numbness and weakness. Balance is a frequent complaint. Nausea and weight loss is a frequent early complaint. And more recently, as we've been seeing more subtle cases, mood disturbance and early mild cognitive impairment are early symptoms. But if this goes on long enough and patients get cobalt levels greater than 100 for prolonged periods of time, the horrific described cases are patients who are blind, deaf, are in thyroid failure, are in heart failure, and have profound peripheral neuropathy, so profound numbness of the hands and legs and weakness too. So they're basically wheelchair bound. So that's an extreme case. Now that we're aware of the entity and we've learned that it's a spectrum illness and patients tend to go to various stages, fortunately, before they wind up dying, deaf, blind, and heart failure and in a wheelchair. The problem is the early symptoms are very common and very nonspecific, being fatigue, is probably the most common early symptom. And if you're a doc in general practice, you got a whole waiting room full of fatigue. Depression is another early sign or symptom. Ringing in the ears and high-frequency hearing loss. You know, what Alaskan middle-aged male that's hung around guns and cylinders doesn't have that? And usually the heart changes are usually fairly subtle at first and not symptomatic. But I think what we're learning as we see more and more patients in Alaska that have had cobalt poisoning, the heart actually may be the most sensitive organ to cobalt. And if you look at patients that have high blood cobalt levels, I think we'll probably often see changes on echocardiogram with a heart before patients really experience these disturbing neurologic symptoms.
So how many people out there now have metal-on-metal hips, and which of them, in your opinion, are at risk?
Every patient that has a metal-on-metal hip needs a cobalt level done. And this just isn't my opinion at this point. This is pretty much It's actually finally been adopted by the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons. Now, they haven't really recommended that doctors go to the point where they call up all their patients that have had metal-on-metal hips and say, come on in and get your cobalt level checked. But they certainly recommend if patients have metal-on-metal hip and they're experiencing any symptoms consistent with cobaltism or they're having any problems at the hip, that they have a cobalt level done. In Alaska, there's probably maybe 200 patients with metal-on-metal hips. At least within our clinic, we've already redone about 35 of those patients. Most all the patients we've redone have had very high blood cobalt levels. And one in three of the patients have had, I think, very clear neurologic toxicity. And when we study the hearts with echocardiogram, all the patients we studied with echocardiogram have had mild stiffening of the heart, which is one of the early signs of the heart muscle not working ideally.
All right. We need to definitely come back to this issue of the symptoms and who's at risk, but we have had a caller that's held on here for a little bit. I want to get her question. Michelle, you're on line one?
Yes, I am.
What can we do for you?
I had a hip replacement after a fall, so I had necessary emergency surgery for partial hip replacement. I was told by both by the orthopedic surgeon and my dentist that for the rest of my life I need to have a strong antibiotic prior to any kind of dental work. This is going to apply to more people than me, but I happen to have allergic reactions to sulfa drugs, and so the antibiotic that they're telling me they will prescribe is clindamycin. But first, let me back up, because I want to ask this guest you have. I went online to look up this requirement about antibiotics prior to dental work, and then I also, of course, looked up that particular antibiotic. I'm holding in my hand, I happen to be in my car, but I'm holding in my hand a new guideline from a joint guideline from both the American Dental Association as well as the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons. It is a revision to that policy, and I'll just read the first.
Yeah, it's let me address this real quick because I can answer your question. Dental, when we give something preventatively, it's called prophylactic treatment. And this has always been an area of concern, and certainly I have seen it in practice that a patient after dental work will get bacteria pushed into their bloodstream and potentially infect a prosthetic hip. What we know is that's a relatively rare occurrence. Patients that are most at risk are patients that recently have had the hip replaced, say within the first year, or probably more at risk during the first 3 months. So I'm well aware of the new guidelines, and I think they're very good. And my interpretation of them, what I tell my patients is, if you're having a routine cleaning and you don't have gum disease, and you're further out than 1 year after your hip, you, by the new guidelines, do not need to bother with the prophylactic antibiotics. If you're having a major dental procedure like an extraction, it's probably a good idea. Patients are probably at somewhat increased risk fairly immediately after the prosthetic joint is done. Certainly within the first 3 months, I tend to err on the side of caution and maybe even tell my patients for the first year that it's not a terribly bad idea to have the prophylaxis. I think there'll be variability among surgeons and dentists as far as how closely they follow the new guidelines. Guidelines are only guidelines. And within those guidelines, if patients are immunosuppressed for a particular reason, like patients on remissive drugs for rheumatoid arthritis, again, patients that have particularly bad gum disease, they'll err more towards recommending the antibiotics. Again, if it's a larger procedure like an extraction, they'll recommend more towards recommending the antibiotics. And for someone like you who has a lot of concerns and issues about antibiotics and have had allergic reactions, you know, they would probably go the other way. And it'd be reasonable not to have the antibiotics as long as you're not getting a major procedure and as long as you don't have a lot of gum disease.
I do not have a lot of gum disease, and my particular concern about this clindamycin, there's a huge important warning about clindamycin. Clindamycin is more likely to cause colitis than many other antibiotics. I can't think of anything worse than for a side effect than getting colitis. But I am in between the 3 months and a year. I'm 9 months out from my hip replacement. And I have a dental appointment next week, and so I feel really, really torn.
I think if you're only having a cleaning, I think you'll probably be very safe either way. The thing with clindamycin is it'd be very unusual to get colitis after a single dose. And when people come in for dental work, it's only a single dose of antibiotics. So I think you're going to do well whether or not you take the prophylactic antibiotics. But that's as solid as I can be. It's an area of controversy, and there's no true right or wrong answer.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okey-doke. So we left this story that we have increasingly that it's clear that the metal on metal hips are leading to excess amounts of cobalt in the bloodstream. In variable amounts, and many patients with this have variable amounts of sensitivity to side effects. Is that where we are, or am I not explaining it well enough? I want to make sure listeners are very clear about what we're talking about.
That's certainly, you know, there are still American surgeons doing hip resurfacings, which are metal on metal. I think there's fewer and fewer every day. At one time, it was a very popular procedure. Hip resurfacing, which is a metal-on-metal hip, has been banned from many countries. It's been banned in public health hospitals in England now because the results are so poor, and so many have had to
not
be...
Not just all cobaltism, but other,
yeah,
other
from
issues.
Yeah, mainly from the local problems around the hip, which orthopedic surgeons have been quite aware of the local problems around the hip because that's what orthopedic surgeons focus on. I think the systemic toxicity issue has really been underplayed, mainly because orthopedic surgeons, when they see their patients, don't spend a lot of time talking about their general health. But what we have now is a population of about 1 million patients in America with metal-on-metal hips that are likely not aware that they're at risk for the systemic toxicity, and they're not likely to come in and see their orthopedic surgeon to be checked unless they perceive they have problems at the hip. And even in Alaska, where our level of awareness has been very high about this problem, we've had some recent cases of patients that have missed successive annual follow-ups because they have not had symptoms at the hip, and they've come into the office and we've discovered that they've actually had the systemic toxicity for some months or years and experienced some surplus illness that could have been prevented, you know, if we had had a systematic program for getting patients in and making sure that the high-risk patients get a cobalt level done. A real interesting segue is right when we thought we were understanding the metal-on-metal problems and we stopped doing the metal-on-metal hips in Alaska, it became apparent to us that another group of patients up here is in trouble with a cobalt-related problem. And these are patients with a metal-on-plastic hip that has a problematic taper junction between a chrome cobalt neck and a titanium stem. That implant has been formally recalled by the manufacturer. It's a Stryker rejuvenate hip. And so far, we've redone nearly as many of those as we have the metal-on-metal hips. The alarming thing is those patients can, many of those patients that have trouble at the hip do have elevated blood cobalt levels as well, not to the same degree as the metal-on-metal patients, but we are seeing the systemic toxicity in those patients as well, which raises the concern that the at-risk population for elevated blood cobalt levels and cobaltism may go well beyond just the patients with metal-on-metal hips. And that's one of the reasons I walked over to WAMI and talked to Dr. Selby, because I think Alaska is uniquely situated to do a fairly large-scale epidemiologic study where we can really define this problem, study it, and really figure out who needs to come in and have a blood cobalt level checked.
Yeah, so, yeah, I think, I guess as a history of doing a little bit of epidemiology before I went into medicine, I find this fascinating. I find it fascinating in the sense that you really do understand what's going on. You're interested enough. You've really done a lot of research. And because you've done a lot of research, Alaska, you keep saying Alaska, but to a large degree to you, because of you, you've started to begin to really investigate this further and further. And it's something that's not going to be picked up, like you said, by most orthopedic surgeons. They're not going to start asking people about it until it becomes really aware. And the problem is making people aware. Finally, different parts of the world are beginning to become more and more aware of it. But the issue keeps getting a little bit deeper and deeper and deeper. It's not just the metal-on-metal heads. It may be cobalt at a titanium junction in the stem. And where is this going to go? What's your thoughts?
Well, it's pretty clear from our Alaskan experience, you know, and I would say Alaskan orthopedic surgeons are very concerned about the problem, and I think we're well ahead of the rest of the world in our level of concern and our realization that we need to check cobalt levels on patients at risk. Mm-hmm. What we lack is a very good systematic means of doing that. The United States doesn't have a total joint registry. Even within a clinic setting, it's difficult to go back and remember all the hips you put in particular patients. And most practices aren't set up to do that epidemiologic type work. And it's interesting, in the Alaska population, of about the 20 patients up here that I think have had clear systemic toxicity, even though the awareness is high among orthopedic surgeons, most of those patients were either self-referred because they heard Thad's show or because they saw their primary doc or their internist who was aware of the problem and checked a blood cobalt level. Right. And there's also a large number of patients in Alaska that have had hip replacements out of state, that even when we get our act organized here and identify all the Alaskans that had metal-on-metal hips or the rejuvenate hips done in Alaska, contact them and bring them in, there's a considerable at-risk population that we may not know about.
Well, I want to get back to your efforts to try to better identify and get information to these patients, particularly here in Alaska. But let me take one more caller. Dan, you're on line one?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me all right?
Sure can.
Sure, I've got a couple quick questions. The hip that I currently have is one of those Stryker rejuvenates, and I'm just wondering what the likelihood is that I'll need to have that replaced.
Have you had a blood cobalt done yet?
I have. My initial numbers were in the mid 2.5 or so. It has been on the rise. I just had one done a week or so ago, and it's a 3.5, which doesn't sound very high in relation to what Dr. Tower was experiencing, but I guess I shouldn't have any at all, so it is a concern to me.
Do you have any symptoms at the hip?
I am having some pain in the hip.
Have you had a metal suppression MRI or an ultrasound done of the hip yet?
Yes, both. And my doctor is keeping an eye on it. And at the last checkup, he said that it looks like it might be deteriorating and that we're going to check it again in June and then make a decision at that point what to do.
How old are you, and do you have any significant medical problems?
I am, let's see, changes every year. This year, I think I'm 57, and no significant medical issues.
So no recent change in hearing, ability to think, numbness in hands or feet, easy fatigability, unaccustomed short-windedness with exercise?
No, not so much. We're in the winter season here, so I've got a little bit of that seasonal affective going on. I mean, it could be the hip that's kind of got me tired, but, you know,
one of the things that concerns me in the rejuvenate patients, and we were discussing this before the show with Dr. Selby and Dr. Woodard, is I'm concerned that the rejuvenate patients that we've seen with toxicity are experiencing toxicity at lower blood cobalt levels than our metal-on-metal patients. And I think this is due to how the cobalt is produced. It's more of a galvanic corrosive mechanism. So chemically, it may be considerably different. If you were my patient, the one thing you have not had done, the two things you haven't had done that I would do now would be an echocardiogram to look at your heart function, and I would get an audiogram to really document your hearing. And if you weren't having undue symptoms at the hip, if you weren't having progressive damage to the tendons or ligaments at the hip, once I had those two baseline studies, I would follow you closely, probably every 6 months, and, you know, ask you these same questions I'm asking you about your general medical condition. And I might repeat that echocardiogram at 6 months or a year to see if there's been any subtle changes in your heart. Because what I've seen to date makes me think that the heart is a canary in the cage. And okay. if you can pick up the toxicity early, we know it's very reversible. But we don't want patients to experience unnecessary illness. On the other hand, we don't want to go in and do revision surgery when it's not required. My concern with the rejuvenate and the metal-on-metal hips is I would be surprised if this upward trend in your cobalt level would reverse itself. Because whether the wear is from the surface wear of metal on metal or one of these taper corrosive issues, it's likely a positive feedback loop. So I think you'll probably continue to trend up.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly once you hit a double digit cobalt level, even the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons recognizes now that a double-digit cobalt level in and of itself is a good reason to do a revision.
I see. One last quick question. I've got a product here, HM. I don't know if it's pronounced chelate or chelate. Are you familiar with this? It's a
I am not familiar with chelation at all, only to the extent that I've reviewed all the case reports of hip-related heavy metal toxicity.
Right.
And though the case reports, you have to realize, have all been extreme cases.
Right.
And in 3 or 4 of those cases, chelation was tried, and those patients had such large metal burden, it was clear that that wasn't effective. And I think this question, I think you bring up a very, very good question for patients with low-grade elevations of blood cobalt as to whether or not some form of chelation is reasonable treatment. And Thad may know more about that than I do, but I have to admit, total and complete ignorance of oral chelation-type treatments.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know if this is helping me at all or not, but I don't think it's hurting, so I can probably continue.
I would strongly recommend following Dr. Tower's recommendations.
Okay. Got it.
All All right. Thanks for your call, Dan. We're in our last couple of minutes. There's another caller, and I don't know if we're going to get to him, but I will if we can. But how can people who hear about this concern get in touch with somebody who knows more about what they're doing? And the point I want to make is for all of us, surgeons, car replacement, car dealers, people who whatever, we're good at what we do all the time. And you're not going to find very many people in the world who know as much about hip replacements and cobaltism as Steve Tower. So if you have some concerns, Steve, how would they best get those questions addressed?
I think every patient who has a hip replacement ought to know what hip replacement they have.
Okay.
Because, you know, I think clearly the cobalt issues, although the at-risk population I think is large, and I think theoretically any patient that has a chrome cobalt modular head in their hip replacement, which is the majority of the hips in the United States, is somewhat at risk. Clearly the highest risk groups and the patients that are going to have symptoms within 5 years of their hip replacement are these patients with metal-on-metal hips and patients with the taper-generated chrome cobalt that are known to have a problem taper like the Rejuvenate or patients that have large-ish chrome cobalt heads on a standard size taper, because the larger heads put higher forces on the taper junction. So if I was to stratify risk, I would put metal on metal patients still number one. I would put the Stryker Rejuvenate patients number two. The third risk group would be patients with Stryker hips with the same ball taper as Rejuvenate has that have chrome cobalt heads, particularly if the head size is greater than 28 millimeters. And then after that, I would throw in other hips with modular chrome cobalt heads.
Okay. Are you guys trying to accumulate a group of people up here in some way that have had the surgery? That surgery is at risk?
Oh, definitely. No, I'm, and that's something that with Jane's help, we're trying to formalize that study. Okay. But and the beauty is we've had this long collaboration with Dartmouth Biomedical where we do explant analysis. And, you know, not only in my practice, but many of the other Alaskan orthopedic surgeons have been very involved in this project and the patients that require revision, getting the explants to me so I can send them to Dartmouth so we can learn more about the biomechanics of the generation of this metal debris.
All right. Pat, I know you're holding on. We're just not going to have time to get to you. If you'll just ask the our engineer, you can send us an email, and we'll see if we can get Dr. Tower to answer your question personally. I want to thank both Dr. Shelby and Dr. Tower for being here today. It's been a pleasure. I wish we had more time. We need to get into this in greater depth, and good luck with all you're doing in this regard.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ed.
Next week, we're going to return, and actually, Prentice Pepperton's going to be here in my replace. I'm going to be gone for a couple of weeks, and he's going to be talking about some issues related to domestic violence with Melissa Immel of the Abused Women's Aid in Crisis organization here in town. I should mention that if you go to alaskapublic.org and look at our website, you can find links to this program that anybody could listen to, and also important resources that deal with the problem today. So why not tune in next week and learn more about domestic violence as well. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media, and Monica Goki was our engineer today. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.